continue in our study of the tabernacle. And of course, we study the tabernacle because it is a type of God's throne in heaven, and because much of what was done in the tabernacle pictures Jesus Christ and the work he has done to enable us to have salvation. Now, if I don't get completely confused by this, that's not it. There we go. Well, I might mention, we purchased the new projector, the small projector there on the table. We purchased with church funds a couple weeks ago. Mr. Eric Johnson did some study. And this one has apparently a much higher light throwing capability. I think it's called lumens or something. So it should work very well for our room here that does have all the light across the back and we don't have curtains. So because of what they call light pollution or diffusion, we are able then to, I think, see quite a bit better with this new projector. And he was able to get it for, I think, a very good deal for us. Now, I want to go over to about slide, once again, I got this thing messed up. There we go. Okay, we want to go over to about slide 46, I believe. Yeah, we went through all this before, so let's kind of go through it. For those who weren't here, you missed all this. Last time we ended up here on the bronze laver, the basin, which was the water bucket or water bowl of some kind that was out in front of the door going into the actual tabernacle building where the holy place and the holy of holies are. So we mentioned that this entire layout of the tabernacle pictures how we approach God. That we do come to the door, and Jesus Christ refers to himself as the door, and we come with an offering, something to give. And of course we give ourselves, we are to be a living sacrifice. But essentially, the sacrifice that we have to give is the one that Jesus Christ already gave for us. And so then that sacrifice is given here by the priest onto this brazen altar, the big square altar that is in the courtyard. And that symbolizes the fact that God then accepts the sacrifice on our behalf, which is Jesus Christ, our Savior. And the next step is to be immersed in the water, in the basin, which would be a type of baptism, of course. And then we are able to go into the holy place, and then as it says in Hebrews, to come directly before the throne of God and make our requests known. Now, we want to talk today about the actual items that are in the holy place. The three items there, of course, are the menorah or the candlestick, the table of showbread, and the altar of incense. We may have time to get through those three today, we'll see. Now, the bronze laver, we went through that last time. Okay, the bronze laver was used for ceremonial washing. The priests were to bathe their entire body when they were ordained. It may have been why Peter told Christ in John chapter 13, don't just wash my head or my feet, but wash my head and my body also. Because he may have felt that he was being put into a type of a priesthood service for Jesus Christ. And of course, Christ said, no, you're already clean, except for your feet. Now, following ordinations, the priests had to wash their hands and feet every time they entered the tabernacle or approached the bronze altar. So that would be at least every morning and every night, because they had to change the wicks and the oil in the lamp every morning and every evening. And the evening is actually between the evenings, the same reference as the Passover. And they also had to burn incense. They had to take some incense and scoop it in a spoon off of the table and put it on the altar of incense. And that responsibility was given to the high priest. Now, this bronze laver is probably not a good rendition. The bronze laver is the one item in the tabernacle. It's not described according to size. Nothing says it's 6 feet or 5 cubits or 3 high or whatever. It just says that it is a basin of water on a stand or a base. It was probably much larger than this. It was probably large enough for a man to immerse himself in. So about the size of a large hot tub, so to speak. And it was probably larger than this because they would not have been able to immerse. I mean, I don't think priests were that small. I mean, they probably were a lot bigger than that, probably normal size. So I would guess that the laver held somewhere around 500 gallons of water. It mentions here that believers are to cleanse their hearts from guilt before approaching God. That, of course, is true. But let's go on now to where we want to get to for today. The holy place, it was the first room that they entered when they came into the tabernacle building. That's the center building that's in the center of the courtyard. Now, last time we talked about the courtyard, how it was made of these various hangings and the way it was put together, and also the various tribes of the Levites, the three divisions of the Levites, and what their responsibilities were. But that was all built around and in support of the actual tabernacle building, the front of which is called the holy place. Now, we're going to go through it by first measurements and materials, then the golden lampstand, then the table of showbread, and the altar of incense. Now, this particular presentation that we purchased doesn't give a lot of detail on these three items, so I've got some other books and other references here that I think help add a lot of understanding as to what these items picture and what they really mean for us. First, let's look at measurements. Much of the pattern of the tabernacle is in a 2-to-1 ratio. So the tabernacle itself was 50 by 100 cubits, so twice as long as it was wide. In this little building, at the front of this, we have again a 2-to-1 ratio. We have 30 cubits along the long end and 10 this way. So in the holy place, it's actually 10 by 20 cubits in size. So again, a 2-to-1 ratio. So that room would be somewhere around, what do they have the holy place here? About 30 feet by 15 feet. So not really that much larger than many living rooms, just a 30 feet long by 15 feet wide. And that would be the holy place. Now all that is in there are those three items. They have the menorah or the lamp, and then the table of showbread, and then the very small altar of incense. Now the cubits of the entire tabernacle, of course, are 30 by 30, or 30 cubits long and 10 wide. The measurements for the most holy place, it's 10 by 10. Now they have the Ark of the Covenant sitting towards the back wall. Now, my understanding of it, it was very likely in the very middle of this 10 by 10 room called the most holy place. And that was the area where the high priest only went into once a year, and that was on the Day of Atonement. Now why would this room be square and the others be all rectangular with a 2-to-1 ratio? Well, the only possible answer is that all altars are square. The altar in the middle of the courtyard is square. All altars in the Bible are square. In fact, virtually all altars that they find anywhere in archaeology in the Middle East are always square, exactly 4x4, 5x5, whatever. And almost all of them have horns or little projections on each of the corners. So the throne room of God apparently in heaven is square, and it really is more of an altar than a room with furniture in it. And of course, he is on at the highest point in it, on top of the mercy seat or the kapart, which is on top of the Ark of the Covenant. So the throne room of God, apparently, in heaven, in the third heaven, wherever that is, or however it's able to be understood by us mere mortals with the great limitations that we have, is that it is a square room, but the front of it here, of course, is the holy place that is rectangular on 2-to-1 ratio. This is a little more detailed diagram. It shows you the way it was written, the way it was diagrammed out. Now, the door here, of course, faces east, which this is sort of backwards. I mean, we all picture maps as pointing north and then east is to our right. In this case, east is to the left. So that would mean that north is up here. So the table of showbread is towards the north, which would be the direction of heaven, the third heaven. And the menorah, or the lamp, as it is called, it's not called plural lamps, but the lamp is in the south end, but giving light this direction. And the altar of incense is here in front of this veil, which is the veil that was torn from top to bottom when Christ died in 31 AD. And that, of course, was the barrier between the holy place, where the high priest went twice a day, every day, and the most holy place, where he only went once a year on the Day of Atonement. So that gives a pretty good overview of what the dimensions were. It's just sort of backwards as far as our east and west orientation normally is. Now, the tabernacle itself, the primary walls were built of boards. They were acacia boards that were about 20. We can read that over there. We might turn over to Exodus 26. I think they were about 28 inches wide and about 10 feet high. In Exodus 26 and verse 15, he mentions, "For the tabernacle you shall make the boards of acacia wood standing upright." And there's a very good picture of this here a little bit later. 10 cubits shall be the length of a board, so 10 cubits would be around, 15 feet maybe? And 1.5 cubits shall be the width of each board, so about maybe 24, 26 inches. 2 tenons shall be in each board for binding to one another. Now the tenons would be the horizontal boards that went across, horizontal. I think building forms, they call them strong backs or whalers if you're a concrete guy and you build forms. But they're tenons, they go across horizontally to hold these boards in place. Now, this is not that much different than cedar fences where we have horizontal 2x4s and then the upright panels for the cedar boards on them. It said, "You shall make the boards of the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side, 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under each of the boards for its 2 tenons. So they have these sockets. I'm sorry, let me go back. Well, I was going to go back, but I guess I got that thing messed up. This other thing here is supposed to go back with it, but I don't do that. Oh. I probably got myself completely messed up here because I'm not very technical on this thing. Yeah, let's do this. Can we go back? There we go. Maybe that's wrong too. I don't want to go this fast. Can we go back through this thing? Do you have to... Now the bottom turns it on and off. That's right, Mr. Reeves. So I don't want to do that. I want to go back two slides, I believe, if we can. Okay, that's good. That's good. That's great. All right, now hopefully I won't mess it up anymore. So, you know, as old people, we have to be careful because we're not technically oriented. So, but when I was down in Florida, you know, my dad's 85, and I had to set up his voicemail for him on his phone because he couldn't do that. So I don't feel too bad then when the kids have to help me with all this computer stuff. So there are 100 sockets. These are the sockets that these upright boards go in to keep the tabernacle building upright. Then there were bars, bars on top, bottom, and then two horizontal bars in the middle of the boards. Then there are pillars and hooks. The hooks hook the boards to the upright posts, or upright pillars. And also there were hooks that hooked the covering. The covering was three layers of cloth, three layers actually of skin and cloth on top. And so the ceiling of this thing was suspended on some rafters. I guess we would call them rafters or ceiling joists. They had to span, you know, 10 cubits or about 18, maybe 20 feet. So I assume they would have to be fairly stout, maybe about, I don't know, like 6x6s or 8x8s or something. And acacia wood would be in density and strength very comparable to oak or locust wood, so a little better perhaps than the fir wood that we use commonly in building here. Then, of course, there were curtains at the entrance of the tabernacle here and curtains at the entrance into the Holy of Holies. Oh, I did it again, didn't I? So there's no way to go backwards on this thing, is there? The right key? Move the arrow. Oh, there we go. Move the arrow right there. This is better than a mouse. Okay, and I click it. Hey, look at that. Okay. Okay, the materials. The coverings for the tabernacle included. The first covering was made of goat's hair with linen beneath. Let's look at Exodus 26 and verse 7. Right there, pretty close anyway. You shall make curtains of goat's hair and a tent over the tabernacle. You shall make 11 curtains. So the first layer that went over the tabernacle was to be woven out of goat's hair. They would take the goats, of course they had probably millions of them and certainly many thousands, and they would shear them and take the hair and card it and then make it into a twine or into a very thick wool, goat's wool, and they then would make that into a large, just kind of rolled linen or rolled material they would put over the top of the tabernacle, somewhat like a tent. Now, it also had linen beneath. And I think that's in Exodus 25 and verse 4. Purple, blue, purple, scarlet thread, fine linen, and goat's hair. So they had this linen that also went with it. And the linen itself was the facing. So the building basically was, you know, wood-colored, acacia wood-colored on the sides. And the ceiling was white. So it was the only thing in the building that would have given it some light besides, of course, the candles or the oil that was burning in the lamps. Now, the second covering was made of ram skin dyed red. That's Exodus 25 and verse 5. We can read that. Well, ram skins dyed red. And then where was he actually given, 26 and verse 14, where it says, "You shall make a covering of ram skins dyed red for the tent and a covering of badger skins above that." Now, that's what we have to look at. So the first layer was woven goat skin, sort of quilted with a white linen bottom to it. So the ceiling of the tabernacle was white, but on top of that was this woven goat skin. Then there was a second covering made of ram skin. The skin, of course, would be much thicker, much heavier. And then it mentions here the third covering on top, and this came all the way down to the bottom and was guyed off with some sort of tent post. They say badger skin. Now this is kind of a difficult Hebrew word to interpret. If you look at a variety of commentaries and those who have studied on the tabernacle, they come up with some kind of strange things. Let's look at this one here. The top covering was made of badger, porpoise, or sea cow skin. Now, the reason why there's confusion is because the Hebrew word says it can mean a number of animals over time. We have some parallels, I suppose, in modern-day English. A red snapper fish looks a whole lot different no matter where you go in the country. Same with a number of other fish that people catch. But what we have here is that, first place, badgers are unclean, and there weren't that many badgers anyway. So if they're going to... Anybody ever try to kill a badger? You can't kill a badger. They're just mean, tough, like a wolverine. So there probably weren't badgers used for their skins. And also they would be an unclean animal, and God, of course, would have nothing unclean, no unclean animal part to be used even in his tabernacle. The second one was porpoises. Now this is sort of outlandish because in the wilderness where they built this thing, they had no boats. And I don't think porpoises somehow flew through the air and landed in their whatever. But also, porpoises are an unclean animal. They're not to be eaten. So that wouldn't be used either, although some commentaries use that. Or sea cow skin. Now, this is even more outlandish. There are traditions that there used to be these big sea cow-looking things in the Red Sea, down by Eilat. And the theory is that Moses sent a bunch of guys down there to build some boats, and they went out and went fishing, caught a bunch of sea cows, and brought them back and skinned them out. That really isn't true. Now, but what do all the three of these things have in common? Badger, porpoise, or sea cow? Well, the only thing they have in common is their color. And in fact, what the Hebrew word here means is dark blue. It does not mean animal of any kind. This commentary I have here by Henry Soltau, called The Tabernacle, I believe gives the best explanation for what this third layer on the tabernacle was actually made of. He says, much question has arisen respecting the animal in our translation called the badger. The Septuagint renders it takash, which means skins of a blue color. Upon comparing the conjectures of many writers on this subject, the late Hamilton Smith seems the most probable. His suggestion is that they were skins of a bluish-gray color from an animal of a stag goat species common in the East. So many of their goats were dark blue or dark gray in color. And he's saying that's what this was referring to, because obviously the second covering was ram skins dyed red, or skins from cattle, and the third covering then would be made from these goats, which would be a clean animal, that were blue in color. And those who have raised goats, they come in all sorts of colors. Some are tricolor, some are, you know, white, brown, but there are blue and dark blue colored goats. So the best explanation that I came up with on this badger skin is that it wasn't badgers, but it was goat skin. One more evidence of that is in Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 10, which uses the same word, blue or badgers, to say it was material that was used to make sandals for people to walk in, or shoes. And we know from history that they didn't use badger skin for sandals, they used goat skins. Goats had a pretty heavy, tough skin, and most of the sandals and the shoes they were wearing back at that time were made out of goats, not out of somebody's badger pieces. So that's one of those enigmas of Hebrew, and the fact that the translators have had a tough time trying to figure out exactly what it did mean, and I think lacking understanding of the clean and unclean meats, some of the modern day or some of the Protestant translators over the years have made some conclusions that are not correct. But that way we would have three coverings on the tabernacle. It's actually four because you count the white linen that was first, but that was sewn together with the first layer of goat's hair that was woven. And then you'd have ram skins for strength in the second layer, and then a color of blue skins or blue goat skins on top. So it would have been essentially, you know, a red, white, and blue covering over the top of the tabernacle. Now, the materials of the tabernacle included 48 boards. Now, where they got these boards that they could cut almost a 2-foot-wide stick out of, almost 15, 18 feet long, I don't know. But there must have been some trees or something in that part of the world at that time. We know that the climate has changed. They may have brought some of these building materials out of Egypt, because building materials were very precious. And when they plundered the Egyptians, they may have brought some of these boards out there with them. But there would have been acacia trees just over the hill down towards the Mediterranean Sea or in some of the higher areas, so they would have had a place to do it. I'm just glad that they didn't ask me to help cut these boards by hand, because it would have been a lot of work. They didn't have any sawmills. They would have had to set these things up and just, you know, cut by hand with some kind of a big bow saw. And it would have been a lot of work to get those boards made. They had 100 sockets made of silver. two for each of the boards, four sockets for under the pillars of the veil. Then they had the bars, and we'll see some good renditions of that, and the pillars and hooks. Am I going backwards again? Why am I going backwards? Move my arrow back this way. Okay, did that do it? Okay. If we're here till 6 o'clock tonight, you'll know it's because I got messed up with this pointer. Okay, the first item of furniture in the tabernacle is the golden lampstand. Now, you'll notice that this is configured very much like the menorah or the lampstand that is inscribed on the Arch of Titus in Rome. Now, that's about the only actual rendition we have of anything that came out of the temple at all. It was after Titus had plundered the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, and he brought all this gold and bowls and all these various things back. On the Arch of Titus in the Roman Forum, there is on the side of the wall there, you can see very clearly these Roman soldiers carrying out a menorah that looks pretty much just like this out of the temple in Jerusalem. So how many have been to Rome and seen that, by the way? I've been there a couple years ago. Nathan, you were there with us, weren't you? Yeah. So if you get to Rome, the two things I wanted to see in Rome were the Arch of Constantine and the Arch of Titus. You know, the Vatican and the other stuff was kind of second on the list. But at any rate, that's the shape of menorah that we have. That's the best idea. And it actually does fit fairly well with the description here. So it's called the golden lampstand. This was, by the way, the most ornate and the most, I think the most important, if you want to call it that, item in this first chamber. Now, this is the rendition I was talking about. This shows you a very good picture of how these boards were set upright and how these tenons or these supporting boards that were horizontal were one on the inside, one on the outside, and they were clamped together with these hooks. That made an upright box. Then there were, on the top, there were some joists or these big beams across the top that would have supported this three layers of cloth. Now, this outside here really should be blue. It should be dark blue. It should not be brown. That's a mistake that they made, apparently, when they made this up. Although most of what they've done here is very good. That's probably something I would change if I were to redo it. Now, let's talk about the lamps and just what the lamp meant. It has a lot of symbolism for us. Jesus Christ is the light, and he was the light to the world. We are to be a light to the world. Let me read you what the candlestick has here. But first, let's go to Revelation chapter 1. Go to Revelation chapter 1. It's important to realize that Jesus Christ is in the middle of the lamps, as he is pictured here in Revelation chapter 1. Now, this tells us not only what the lamps symbolize, because he says very plainly it symbolizes the seven heirs of the church. And by understanding that there are seven heirs also of the Old Testament church, then it symbolizes that Christ was in all of these. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 10 says, I was in the Spirit on the Lordian era, or the Lordian time, the time when Jesus Christ, the Lord, is ruling. It has nothing to do with a Sunday or a day of the week. It means simply the era of time when the Lord sets his hand to rule. And that's what the book of Revelation is about, the story of Jesus Christ returning to rule the earth and the era when he will be dominant. So I was in the Spirit during the Lordian era, and I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet, saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. That's the Greek equivalent of the YHVH, the eternal, the ever-existing one, the one that was, is, and will be. It says, what you see, write in a book, and send it to the seven churches which are in Asia. He lists those, of course, Ephesus, Smyrna, and all the way down to Laodicea. I turned to see the voice that spoke with me. So he turned around, John did, to say, who is talking to me? And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. Now, this has been renditioned a couple ways. One case I've seen it, there's kind of a circle of individual lampstands with Jesus Christ standing in the middle. But very likely more than that, the main central stem right here of this lampstand maybe what it's talking about, with Jesus Christ in the middle. So he would have been standing either in front of this or basically in this vision, he would have been the post that supported all of these various lamps. Because the post is written up, the central core of it is written up kind of in that way that we'll read about in a few minutes in Exodus. But he was in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with the garment down to the feet and girded with his chest with a golden band, obviously the resurrected Jesus Christ, the one who is now at the right hand of God. His head and his hair were white like wool, as white as snow, And his eyes were like a flame of fire. Now, this is not the little tiny baby in a manger or a dead person hanging on a cross that's typically worshipped in modern day Christianity. It says his feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, so very sparkly and shining, all sorts of fire and light emanating from his feet. His voice as the sound of many waters, so very loud and also very attractive. He had in his right hand seven stars. Out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was like the sun shining in its strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead, but he said to me, "Don't do that." He said, "Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am he who lives and was dead." It's a very solid proof that Jesus Christ was dead for 3.5 days, 3 days and three nights. He was not off in some other chamber somewhere. "Now behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of Hades and of death. Write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. The mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands." That would be these seven golden lampstands pictured here. He said, "The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands which you saw are the seven churches." So we know that these lampstands each represent a church era, also very likely the physical Israel, but also spiritual Israel churches. Now let's go back to Exodus chapter 35, verse 31. It's important we spend some time on this particular item because this was the most ornate, the most decorated, the most attractive item in the holy place. It was rivaled only by the Ark of the Covenant, which would have been in the different room. But in Exodus chapter 35, beginning in verse 31, I'm sorry, 25. I didn't bring my glasses today, so I should start carrying an extra pair in the briefcase. Yeah, Exodus 25. I'm sorry, Exodus 25, beginning in verse 31. "You shall also make a lampstand of pure gold." So this was made out of pure gold. It was not an alloy. It says, "The lampstand shall be of hammered work." This was not made out of molten gold poured into a mold. This was hammered out. It was taken from sheets of gold and then hammered out by a craftsman to look like what he wanted it to look like. "Its shaft," that's the shaft, is the central part. "Its branches," there are three branches on each side and one on top. It says its bowls. Now the bowls are the little bowls on top for holding olive oil that would then be burned. That's where the lamps actually were. "Its ornamental knobs." Now the knobs are the central part that attach the shaft to the two arms that come out. So these are called knobs or knops, as they would, depending on how they pronounce it or how they spell it. And then there were flowers. The flowers are decorative pieces. There are three or four on each arm, and even some going up and down the shaft. And we'll talk about those each individually. But it says they are to be then of one piece. Verse 32, it says, "Six branches shall come out of its sides, three branches on the lampstand of one side, and three branches of the lampstand out on the other side." And that's exactly what we have here. "Three bowls shall be made like almond blossoms on one branch, with an ornamental knob and a flower. And three bowls made like almond blossoms on the other branch, with ornamental knob and a flower. And so for the six branches that come out of the lampstand." So we have these bowls on top of each one of these. "The lampstand itself, four bowls shall be made like almond blossoms, each one an ornamental knob and a flower." So there were some other decorative type things around there, but basically the flowers and the bowls were the important things. "There shall be a knob under the first two branches of the same knob, and a knob under the second two branches of the same, and a knob under the third two branches of the same, according to the six branches that extend from the lampstand." So that's the knobs that hold these two branches in place. The word for knob, by the way, is the same word for lintel. It holds a lintel above a door, holds the two door-supporting jambs together or door-supporting posts together. "The knobs and their branches shall be of one piece, and all of it shall be hammered in pure gold. You shall make seven lamps for it, and they shall arrange the lamps so they shall give light in front of it." Now, we're familiar with the use of light in the Scripture. And these seven burning bowls here, even though some of the translations have it in plural, they are always referred to in this Hebrew as singular. This is not the seven lamps, it is the single lamp in the tabernacle or in the holy place. It doesn't send forth lights, it sends forth its light. And that's symbolizing that all seven areas of God's church, of course, are unified. They're not seven separate churches, but they are indeed all one. Now, Jesus Christ said in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5, where it said about him, that in him was a light, in him is no darkness at all. Remember, he is in the middle of these seven lamps. He was the true light, which lights every man that comes into the world, in John chapter 1 and verse 9. In John chapter 8 and verse 12, he says, I am the light of the world. Now, life is also an indispensable attendant upon light, and light is connected with life. Jesus Christ is the light bringer, but he's also the light life giver. He said, in him was life, and his life was the light of men, in John chapter 1 and verse 4. He says, he that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life, in John 8 and verse 12. So we have quite a number of verses, just in the book of John alone, that picture Jesus Christ as the light that gives life, and also the light that lights our path and gives us proper direction. Of course, God's word is called a light to our path and a lamp unto our feet. The candlestick of gold seems to shadow forth this mystery, that we find a union between the light and Jesus Christ and ourselves. The candlestick was the most elaborate of all the vessels of the sanctuary, as to its workmanship being richly ornamented. The other vessels were studiously plain. This was a beaten work, a word which conveys the idea of solidity as well as being wrought by hand, in other words, carefully crafted by a craftsman, not just simply poured into a mold. The workman who had to fashion such a richly chased vessel must have pondered minutely over every part and must have bestowed intense labor and skills on every portion. His tool must be guided by careful and unerring precision so as to form delicate flowers that adorned it. Doesn't this afford us an apt illustration of how Jesus Christ deals with us as individuals and as a church? Now let's look at the three items first. The bowls like almonds. Now the bowls, of course, were on top of the... Where did I go here with that? There we go. I think our battery's getting low here on the... There it is. The bowls were on top of each one of these branches. They were probably about the size of a large coffee cup. They held in them a wick. Not much different than the small hand lamps they would carry when they were walking at night in place of flashlights or the kind of lamps they would place in their homes. But it would have enough oil to burn for a little over 12 hours. And they would have a wick probably made of flax, woven in very tightly woven flax, that would be immersed down into the oil. It says the bowls, there were three sets of ornaments in this beautiful vessel, bowls or cups like almonds, knops, and flowers. As to the first, the bowls like almonds, as we have an analogy in the fruit yielded by Aaron's rod, which were almonds. So the very top of these menorah, these candles, these lamps, were shaped like almonds, symbolizing Aaron's rod, which had been used to perform miracles and also to bring the people out of the land of Egypt. This rod has been referred previously to as a type of Christ. It may be remarked here that the almond was selected for Aaron's rod probably because it is the first tree in the Middle East to awake from the sleep of winter. So the first tree that buds out and blossoms in the Middle East apparently is the almond tree. Now around here we're sort of in rhododendron season right now. We've had some beautiful rhodies that come out every year. I think if we had a little warmer weather we might have a few more, but certainly the rhodies have been beautiful and the azaleas are coming out. Maybe the first flower around here though is something else. I'm not exactly sure. But there is a first flower or a first flowering tree in each area. And Aaron's rod of an almond tree symbolized that in the Middle East. Its early vigor heralds the approach of spring before the other trees have even put forth leaves. This may presage that Jesus Christ is the firstborn among many brethren. So these bowls shaped like almonds were on top, and they would hold enough olive oil to burn at least 12 hours so that whenever the high priest came in, he could refill the bowl and then pull the little wick out and clip off part of it that would be burnt and needed to be cut, needed to be trimmed. Then the knops, he says it's difficult to define what kind of ornament the knops were. They were probably just a round globe or a round heavier part of the structure, strong enough to hold the arms in place, strong enough to make sure that it was solid. He says the word is also used in Amos and Zephaniah, where it is translated as a lintel of a door. Josephus refers to this word as pomegranate. So it's possible they, you know, pomegranates around, it may have had the, you know, the dimpled decoration of a pomegranate on it. From their situation placed under the branches, I'm inclined to think the knops were like opening flower buds out of which the branches apparently sprouted. So they may have also had sort of an opening look to them. Then we have the flowers. The flowers were the ornaments that especially showed the skill of the workman who fashioned this beautiful vessel. The candlestick is spoken of as beaten gold under the shaft thereof and under the flower thereof. Now the Septuagint translates this word flowers as lilies. Now whether or not these flowers were shaped like a lily. Now, the flowers, by the way, decorated the menorah, decorated the candlestick, probably 3 to 4 times on each one of these shafts, and then some up and down on the main shaft. So were they shaped like a lily, or, you know, like a rose or like a tulip? We really don't know. Certainly the Vulgate translators and also the Septuagint translators thought it was more like lilies. It's possible. Jesus Christ refers in Matthew 6:28 to the lilies of the field, and how they have all this beauty, more than Solomon, yet they toil not. But in all these passages, including in 1 Peter 1 and verse 24, the glory of man is compared to the fleeting beauty of a flower, which after time withers and falls to the ground. In all these passages, the flower is an emblem of beauty and glory, though fading and passing away. Now, this presentation leaves out a couple things here that we need to look at. The first is the oil that was burned in the lamps. Let's go over to Exodus chapter 27. Exodus chapter 27, beginning in verse 20. These lamps were to be burning continually. Once they were lit, they were not supposed to go out. The high priest had to trim them and refill the oil twice a day, once in the morning, and between the evenings at sunset every night. Notice verse 20, you shall command the children of Israel that they bring you pure oil of pressed olives for the light, to cause the lamp to burn continually. Now, one very important aspect of the tabernacle is that all Israel had to contribute to it. In other words, they all had to contribute to the building and the upkeep and maintenance of this tabernacle while it was there. You know, God could have simply just snapped his fingers and poof, had it all built and had, you know, one of these cruses of oil that doesn't run out. He could have had bread and flour that magically appeared, but he didn't. He made sure that every tribe of Israel, and in fact every Israelite, felt a certain responsibility to provide the oil, provide the flour for the meal offerings, and also to contribute to the physical building of the tabernacle the first time it was put up. So here we have all the people of Israel were to bring pure oil pressed of olives for the light. Now, some of this is maybe a little bit different translation, because one place says it is to be beaten. Let me see, I think that's Exodus 27:20. The word here when it says pressed actually is beaten. There are three types of olive oil. For those who go to Trader Joe's and places, you probably already know this. But the purest olive oil, they put the olives, and then they beat them. They put them on something, perhaps they put them on a, you know, concrete block or a rock or whatever. And as they beat the olives with these wooden baseball bat type things, the olive oil kind of explodes out of the olives. And then they drain that down into a container and strain it. And that's a very light, a very clear, almost tasteless olive oil. And that's what God required to be used in the tabernacle. It was the purest olive oil available. The olive oil is also pressed. And in modern-day stores, you'll find oil that says extra virgin olive oil. What that means is that the olives are picked, they are not heated, they are cold, and they are put in this press, and they press it down with one of these screw impeller-type things, and they press the oil out, and then the pulp that's left over, they then put in a much larger vat, and they heat it. And the heat then releases additional oil out of the olive pulp. And that's your standard olive oil. Unless it says extra virgin, it means it has been heated. Now, there are some people that feel that the heating of the oil contaminates it or makes it less digestible for human consumption. So a lot of the naturopath purists always want you to buy extra virgin olive oil. I always thought extra virgin olive oil meant, you know, young teenage girls were up there squeezing it around and they were the ones that harvested the trees or something. But that was back in my ignorant days. I've learned a lot since then, and that's not what it really means. It really means that the olives have not been heated yet, and the pulp had not been heated yet in the fire, in the stove. So the oil that's the very lightest and the best was beaten and was drained out of the beaten olives, and that's what God required to be used in the tabernacle. Let's go over to Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 1. Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the children of Israel that they bring to you pure oil of pressed olives or beaten olives for the light, to make the lamps burn continually." So that had to be organized somehow, with each tribe having 1 month of the year when they were responsible for the oil. We don't know exactly how Moses organized it. We just know that it did occur. "Outside the veil of the testimony in the tabernacle of meeting, Aaron shall be in charge from evening until morning." Now, the veil of testimony is the veil right here. And this area here is called the testimony of meeting. Anyone know why that is? No? Because when it says that Moses went to meet with God, he went into here and stood in front of the incense. Now, God was on the other side. So Moses didn't look at him and die. And so when Moses, all during that 40 years in wilderness, would meet with God, there was smoke and the presence of God very, very obviously in the Holy of Holies. And Moses didn't walk in there and see him. Moses went into this room that's called the Tent of Meeting, or the Meeting Room. It's also called the Holy Place. But Moses would walk in and stand right here in front of this veil that separated him from God and kept him from seeing God's actual presence and glory and then dying. But when you read the word, the tabernacle of meeting, that's what it means. I didn't know that for a lot of years. I kept reading the tabernacle of meeting, and you think, well, Aaron met people and they brought in animals and they killed them and all of that. And I used to think the tabernacle of meeting was the entire thing, but it's not. The tabernacle of meeting is this also called the holy place, which is where Moses went to meet with God. So outside the veil of testimony, in the tabernacle of meeting, Aaron shall be in charge of it from evening until morning before the Lord continually. Now, being a high priest meant you never had a day off. The high priest had to go in the morning and in the evening and trim these lamps and also to burn incense. So the high priest didn't have many days off at all. I'm sure if he was, you know, sick or whatever, he could have one of his sons do it, who were also qualified to be the high priest. That's one reason why perhaps in the first century in the temple of Herod, the high priesthood office was rotated every year, because that way a guy could, you know, have some vacation time or whatever it would be. But Aaron, the high priest, was in charge of this tabernacle of meeting room, and he had to change that fire, that oil in the fire, every morning and every evening. Notice verse 4, "He shall be in charge of the lamps on the pure gold lampstand." The lampstand pictures Jesus Christ and his giving light to the church and light to the world, but it had to be made of pure gold because he, of course, stands for purity. Notice, before the Lord continually. So this light is burning before the Lord continually. Now, the olive tree used in the scripture pictures a type of richness, of fertility, of beauty. Now, the olive tree in Judges chapter 9 and verse 9 says, allegorically says, "The olive tree says, shall I leave my fatness wherewith they honor God and man with me?" In other words, the olive oil that honors God and man. Psalm, was it 52, says, "I am like a green olive tree in the house of God." A number of other places that the olive tree is used as a symbol of either God's spirit or God's presence with us. And so the high priest had to go in there once every single day and every single night, turn those lamps and make sure that they were working properly and that the oil was filled up. Now, I want to go through the purpose of the light. The light actually had three biblical purposes. The light sent forth by this beautiful vessel, though proceeding from seven lamps, was called one light. The lamps are never said to send forth their lights, but simply the light. The oil ministered to each one was the same, and is always specified for the oil for the light, not for the lamps. Again, in Exodus chapter 27 and verse 20, now there are some modern translations that they've taken upon themselves to make it in the plural, but it is not the case in the original Masoretic text. It says they use the expression to cause the lamp to burn always. There are three specific purposes in the Bible for which this golden vessel with its seven lamps of light stood. The first was that it might shed light before the Lord. Notice he lighted the lamps before the Lord as the Lord commanded. That's Exodus 40, verse 25, that Moses lit the lamps before the Lord. The candlestick shed his light in God's presence. He could look upon its perfectness and beauty. Even he was light, and in him was darkness, no darkness at all could see that. So it was to light the area where God's presence was going to be. Although they would, of course, had this separation here, but there would have been some light would have gotten across the top of the barrier of the curtain. The second purpose of the light in Exodus chapter 26 and verse 35 says, "You shall set the table without the veil and the candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle towards the south. You shall put the table on the north side of it." So the light here is on the south. This is on the north, and this light from here shines on the showbread. The showbread table is illuminated by the light of the candlestick, and the candlestick then gives light to the entire room. But part of its purpose was to show light on the candle on the table of showbread, so that the high priest and could change the loaves out once a week, and every day could scoop up some incense from twice a day, scoop up incense from the bowl where it was stored there, and place it on the incense burning altar. So this was placed opposite to and cast its light upon the showbread table. The third purpose, Exodus 25 and verse 37, it says, "They shall light the lamps that they may give light over against it." In other words, that the light would light up itself, that the candlestick would light up itself. In other words, it would illustrate that Jesus Christ, pictured by the candlestick, would be among the churches or the heirs of God's church down through time. The seven lamps are lighted up and make manifest the solid shaft of beaten gold, the lovely and delicate flowers of the branch. Now in Exodus chapter 30, let's go over there, Exodus chapter 30 and verse 7 and 8. We have the time of lighting and dressing of the lamps. Exodus chapter 30, we'll begin in verse 7. Let's start in verse 6. "You shall put it before the veil," that's before the Ark of the Testimony, "before the mercy seat," that's over the testimony, "where I will meet with you." So in other words, this is the area of meeting or the room of meeting that he talked about. Verse 7, "Aaron shall burn on it sweet incense every morning." That's the small altar of incense, the small altar that's right here in front of this area of meeting or this front of the veil. It says, "When Aaron lights the lamps at twilight," that's the same word as we use at Passover between the evenings, "he shall burn incense on it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations." So it should be every morning and every evening that Aaron would do this trimming of the candlestick lights and making sure they had enough oil. A third fact with ordering of the vessel is that in the directions given for lighting and dressing the lamps, Aaron alone is mentioned as the one who is undertaking the service. Now, Aaron is the high priest of ancient Israel. All of his sons and grandsons, the firstborn, inherited that office. But Jesus Christ is our high priest, and he is today at the throne of heaven. And he alone makes possible our admission into God's throne or into God's house and be part of that household of God. It is his work. Obviously, he has angels assisting him and that type of thing, but when it really comes down to giving light and to giving God's Spirit and to making our sins forgiven, it is Jesus Christ working alone, just like it was the high priest working alone in that room all down to the time when it was physically here. This peculiar work was entrusted to the high priest and to him only. We see the immediate typical reference here to the Lord Jesus himself, our great high priest, whose living power and love God alone has entrusted to the glory and safekeeping of the church. He is able to present himself a glorious church without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. Now, in addition to the candlestick, there were several little items along with it. Let's go to Exodus chapter 25 and verse 38. Now, these, by the way, are not mentioned in this video presentation. They probably thought it wasn't necessary, but there are a couple little things later that show some of it. In Exodus 25 and verse 38, Its wick trimmers and their trays shall be of pure gold. Now, this word wick trimmers is translated by most people as tongs, the same type of, you know, big tweezer-type tong things that you would use to cook steaks on the grill. And also it has trays made of pure gold. It shall be made of a talent of pure gold. A talent, some commentaries believe it was 75 pounds, some as high as 125. But first let's talk about the tongs. The tongs were used for two different things. The first, they would use the tongs to grab the wick that was burning and pull it up out of the lamp while they poured additional oil in there, or to pull it out so they could trim it off with a knife, the part of that flax wick that would be crusted black and need to be taken off. So the word translated in Exodus here as snuffers, or as in my New King James Version, wick trimmers, is rendered tongs in all their places where it occurs. And this seems to be the correct translation. It's found in Numbers, several different places here, chapter 4, verses 9, 1 Kings 7, verse 49, 2 Chronicles, also in Isaiah. And, of course, it is always translated as tongs. On one purpose, they would dress the lamps. They would use these tongs to raise the wick and make it burn more brightly. And besides this, they would also use the tongs to grab live coals from the incense altar that were needed at the incense altar and remove them to the censer when that vessel was used. So they would use it to grab, first they had to go outside and get coals off the altar and bring those into the incense altar, and they would burn those there and then put incense on it, and those tongs would have been used for that. And also there was a little bit more when they, once a year when the high priest would get this pan to burn incense on, probably the size of a large, like a pie dish, with a kind of three chains to hold it on, and he would go over with the tongs and put coals of incense burning on that and then put additional incense on it and go into the Holy of Holies, and the smoke coming off that incense would keep him from dying by being in the presence of God. So these plates that were mentioned here, or actually it's actually called in this translation trays, same thing. That was used only once a year, and that would be to transport the incense into the Holy of Holies. They may have used some also to go out to the main altar and grab some hot coals and then carry them in and then with the tongs put them onto the incense, the altar of incense here, which also had to twice a day be put have incense put on it. It says the ancient censer was merely a pan of gold or brass to receive the burning coals with a long handle attached to it, wherewith the priest was able to carry it full of fire. So some believe it had a long handle on it, like a big frying pan with a long handle on it. On the burning coals, it was thus carried and was thrown. The reason for connecting golden censer with the candlestick and not with the incense altar was to link together and combine the different vessels of ministry and all the great acts of service. So when that was transferred around, the incense was taken off the showbread table, and of course the tongs were a part of the candlestick, and then the fire came from the great altar and was put onto the smaller incense altar. So basically all the items worked together there during that time of putting the prayers, what symbolized the prayers of God's people, together. So we have there the altar of incense. I'm sorry, right here. But here we have then the candlestick and all the various things that it represents. Certainly something that we could probably spend a lot more time on. But let's go on to the next item. Somehow that didn't work. Okay, I may have turned it off again. Okay, there we are. I think your battery's getting low on this thing, Fred, because the laser's not working. There, it started working. Okay, shouldn't that be going forward? Going backwards again? Okay, I shouldn't be doing that, should I? Okay, let's go over here. So you take your eye off what you're doing and make mistakes.
If you have problems with it, point it towards the computer.
Oh, okay. Okay, this is just a summary here, and we've already covered most of these items, so we'll go through it fairly quickly. Let's go back over to the forward thing and up. Okay, there we go. Okay, the lampstand was made of one talent, or about 125 pounds, give or take some, of pure hammered gold. Had a central shaft of six branches, three on each side, and each branch had knobs, flowers, and an almond-shaped bowl on the top to hold the olive oil so it could be burned. Okay, now why isn't this going? I That do it? No. There we go. All right. Now we're in good shape. The priest's duty was to trim the wicks and keep the lamps lit. The lampstand was designed to provide light for the tabernacle, but also to provide light for itself and for the table of showbread. The lampstand was the first item seen. There are several scriptures here about the Word of God as a light for believers. The Bible says that Jesus is God's Word in the human form. And he also, of course, said that he was the light of the world and his followers would not have to worry about living in darkness. Okay. Now, the light of Christ lives inside believers. That's true. Believers are God's light or witness to the world. There we go. And they've got a little candle here. The followers of Jesus Christ are to be called lights in dark places. And use that, of course, said you are like a light sit on city on top of a hill. Okay. I said something else wrong. Up. There we go. Table of showbread. The table of showbread is in the south side, or I'm sorry, the north side of the north side here of the altar, or of the tabernacle building. There we go. There's the table of showbread. Now, there should be one more. Okay, it was made of acacia wood, overlaid with gold. The table had a crown of gold around its edge. I want to go back to that. Maybe it's on the next one. But it also, this picture they've got of it doesn't show the crown of gold very well. It actually was more like a lip, because when they carried the tabernacle items from one campsite to the next, they had to leave the vial of wine or the flask of wine and also the 12 loaves on there, and they had to have a little lip just in case they sort of moved a little bit. And the rendition here doesn't show that very well. A ring of gold put on each side of the four legs of the carrying poles, and the carrying poles were made of shittim wood overlaid with gold. So let me see if I can get there we go. Well, if we talked about those, let's go back a little bit. I think that I need to go back to the picture. There we go. Okay. Now, okay. There we go. That's the picture I want right here. Notice there are 12 loaves, six on each stack. Let's read that over in Exodus 25. They each represent one tribe of Israel. Now, keep in mind, of course, there's the physical Israel of the Old Testament, and their spiritual Israel, obviously, in Revelation 7 and 14. The picture is the church. But these loaves are leaven. Just like all of us as people, we come to God, we still have sin. These are not unleavened loaves that would picture a sinless offering or a sinless person. These are leavened loaves, picturing very much that, you know, we come to God with our sins, even though and God accepts us because of Christ's sacrifice and what he did for us. Exodus 25 and verse 23. You shall make a table of acacia wood. 2 cubits shall be its length and a cubit its width. Again, we have this 2-to-1 ratio. So it's about 40 inches long and about 20 inches wide. And it says 1.5 cubits its height. So only about 30 inches off the floor. It was fairly low to the ground. It wasn't as high as most modern day cabinets would be. You shall overlay it with pure gold and make a molding of gold all around it. So they were to make a molding around it. This picture here sort of shows a little lip, but not quite enough. The lip was probably a little bit higher than that. You shall make a frame of a handbreadth all around, and you shall make a gold molding for the frame all around. So they were to decorate it with a gold molding and frame around it, but certainly the top, because we didn't want these pans to slip and fall off when they were carrying it, had a little lip around it. You shall make for it 4 rings of gold and put the rings on the 4 corners that are on its 4 legs. So we have the rings, obviously, for these poles of acacia wood to be used to transport it back and forth. You shall make the poles of acacia wood, overlay them with gold, and the table may be carried in them. You shall make its dishes, its pans, its pitchers, and its bowls for pouring. You shall make them of pure gold. Now, in this tabernacle, there was only one of these tables. Now, according to Josephus, by the time they built the huge temple in Jerusalem in the first century, the temple we call the Temple of Herod, he says there was a dozen tables of showbread in that temple, that there were so many people living there and so many areas where they had all this bread and so many priests, and they had to go on these 24 courses and, you know, maybe 1 to 1.5 million people coming into Jerusalem for the feast, that they duplicated some of these items all over in the several different rooms in the temple area. So when the Romans pillaged the temple in Jerusalem, they would have had maybe hundreds, but dozens and dozens of large bowls that were made of pure gold. They would have had all sorts of these little utensils and various things all made of pure gold. And so we know that the Colosseum in Rome was built out of the money that was pillaged, the gold that was pillaged from the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. It's a kind of an anomaly of history that the building was used then to persecute and kill Christians for about 300 years. But the value of that gold would have been astronomical, because it would have been hundreds and hundreds of these bowls that were used on this table of showbread. Now, this table doesn't show the bowls. There were bowls here that were used to keep frankincense, which is a very pure white type of incense. And there were two of those, one on each end. And the other bowls that sat there would hold the other incense, the incense that was made of four different kinds of aromatic incense that was beaten together and mixed. And that's what the priests actually put on the altar of incense to burn. So the dishes, pans, pitchers, and bowls for pouring. Now, there also was a pitcher of wine on the table that was replaced every week. By the way, that makes an interesting sidelight, is that these 12 loaves of bread were made of leaven, and they were replaced once every Sabbath. On the Sabbath, those bread items were replaced. Now, what would most of us do with bread that was sitting out for a week? I mean, it's probably got green hair growing on it and kind of moldy and kind of dry. My wife says I would still eat it, but most people wouldn't eat it. But the truth of the matter is, God miraculously kept that bread from going bad or from molding or from going stale every single week it was there. That at the end of the week, that bread then was given to the priest to eat. So they were then to eat the bread at the end of the week, showing that God had miraculously preserved this bread during that time. And that, of course, illustrates that God miraculously preserves us. He keeps us alive and He keeps us close to Him, and He gives us all that we need to sustain ourselves during not only every single week, but during our entire life. So the table of showbread, it's called a place where the church has fellowship with God. I'm not quite sure that I agree with all of that. But certainly the bread on the table is very important. In Leviticus 24 and verse 5, directions are given respecting the bread to be placed on the table. God says, "You shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes thereof. 2/10 deal shall be in one cake. You shall set them in two rows, six on a row." And here are the two rows with six apiece. And says, "Upon the pure table before the Lord." Now, the flour could not be coarse ground. It couldn't be, a mixture of all these, modern things that we find at the various health food stores where they have all this coarse ground this and coarse ground that and flax and all sorts of different things. This was to be pure, finely ground flour. That's the only material that this bread was to be made of, just flour and water. This is the great constituent of this offering, and we have direct authority of the word itself for saying this offering was a type of Christ, written in Psalm 40, verses 6 to 8. It says, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required." So this bread offering, the fact that it was beaten fine, it was ground fine, is also a type of how God's people, we are not to be coarse. We're to have ourselves somewhat refined to become pure as possible with God's help. He says, "We know how to estimate the value and gentleness and grace which we see in this fine flour as the servants of God around us. This is in them generally the result of long and often painful discipline. But this fine flour was to be taken or baked into 12 cakes before presented on the table. He that came into the world was as the fine flour, had to pass through trials, sorrows, temptations during his path below, and certainly all of us do too. The cakes were 12 according to the number of the tribes, in order that each tribe might eventually have its memorial presented before God on the holy table of the same material, the same weight, and the same size." And of course, that symbolized us also. In Leviticus 24 and verse 7, if you're close there, I want to turn over to that point. Leviticus 24 and verse 7. Helps if I get in the right book. Okay. We have here this frankincense. Leviticus 24 and verse 7. "You shall put pure frankincense on each row." So there was to be frankincense. There's these two rows. So each one of those rows of the bread had to have a little bowl of frankincense next to it. That it may be on the bread for memorial, even an offering made by fire unto the Lord. So we have these little bowls of frankincense that were either put on top of or adjacent to the bread that was on top on this on the table of showbread. The Hebrew word translated frankincense is derived from a root which means to be white. The word Lebanon is derived from the same root, so-called because of the snow-clad mountains. Frankincense was a growth of earth as well a fine flower. It came from trees. The Song of Solomon mentions the trees that produce frankincense. It seems to be added to the cakes upon the table in order to express another aspect of truth because it was pure white. So basically a pure white powder of frankincense that was put on the top of or right next to these loaves, symbolizing that they were to become white. It's interesting that when Christ was receiving the gifts from the Magi or the wise men, some think there are three wise men, others think maybe 12, that it was gold and frankincense. Of course, all the items in the tabernacle here in these two rooms were made of gold, and frankincense was placed next to the showbread, symbolizing purity and righteousness and whiteness that we were all to try to attain. So the myrrh, I'm not quite sure exactly, other than just a sweet-smelling perfume, what that would have been used to symbolize, but certainly frankincense and gold were part of the holy place here, and were given as two of the gifts to the Christ child by the Magi. It mentions here, the Lord intrinsically was a man typified by fine flower and all the fragrance development of the frankincense. Every Sabbath, he was to set in order. This is Leviticus chapter 29, I'm sorry, chapter 24 and verse 8. It says, every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel as an everlasting covenant. So these cakes, these 12 cakes of fine flour, were to be taken from the people of Israel. They had to contribute the flour for it, and perhaps even do some of the baking. It doesn't say who did the baking. Probably the Levites did. But every Sabbath, then, it was to be changed out. The seventh day was the first rest of God upon this earth. The seventh day pictures, of course, the millennium when Jesus Christ will return and have 1,000 years of his reign here. But the presentation of fresh bread on the table every Sabbath seems to connect these thoughts of rest and joy and remuneration or refreshment from the Lord, of the blessed remembrance of the character and the obedience of Christ. One subject of interest and instruction respecting these types is the fact that all the various parts of the tabernacle, as well as the sacrifices, were provided and presented by the people of Israel. It seems to be the special intention of God strongly to mark thereby their close identification with all those blessed things. Now today, of course, we are to be a living sacrifice, and we give that, we apply that to ourselves. Now I want to mention something here just in passing that's fairly important. In verse 8 of Leviticus 24, we're already there. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. So the word continually means there is always going to have this showbread there. This showbread that typifies the 12 tribes of Israel and also the 12 tribes of the church or spiritual Israel. And it says this was to be a continual offering. In Exodus 25 and verse 30, it says, the table of showbread will be there before me always. It became known as the continual bread. In Numbers chapter 4 and verse 7, it is called the continual bread. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 4, it's referred to as the continual showbread. Now the Hebrew word that means continual, just means ongoing, that is used here as this continual bread, is also used in Daniel chapter 12 and also chapter 8 and chapter 11 in reference to the sacrifices. And there it says, when the daily sacrifice is taken away, then it says the beast power and various things are going to happen. Only the word sacrifice is not in the Hebrew, not in the original in the book of Daniel. What is there is the word continual, and it is the exact same word that is used here for the continual showbread, the continual bread, and the continual offering. So when so many people are waiting with bated breath for a group of renegades to charge the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and to rebuild some sort of an altar and then have a red heifer's ashes spread around and then start doing sacrifices, and then somebody comes in and stops them And that means the daily sacrifice has been taken away, so it's time to all get on their suitcases and fly to Jordan. That's not really what is meant in the book of Daniel. My understanding is that this continual offering of these 12 tribes, when that is taken out of the way, when the continual worship of God, or when this everyday offering to God that has been going on really since the beginning of Seth, when Seth began to worship God in the correct way, when that continual worship of God is taken away, then it is time for the two witnesses. That's all that's left, because the true worship of God, those people are taken to a place of safety or are out of the way somewhere. There no longer is an organized continual offering going on the earth. And then all we have left are the 3.5 years. And during that time, the only two who represent the true church of God are called the two witnesses. So when you look at the words in Daniel chapter 11 and 12 especially, and you see that where it says, until the daily sacrifice is taken away, it's not the word sacrifice meaning an animal having his throat cut and being burned over there in Jerusalem. It means this continual bread that symbolizes us people who have faults and problems but are an offering to God because God has called us. So when you see the people of God taken out of the way, then we know that we only have 3.5 years before these things occur. One last time thing that we have time for here. Priestly service was of very varied kinds. The priests had not only to offer gifts and sacrifices, to put incense before God and whole burnt offerings on the altar. They had to teach Israel God's judgments and His law. So the priests were teachers. They were butchers, I guess you could say. They had to have these animals' parts, you know, burned upon the altar. They had to be caretakers. They were custodians. They had to take care of the rooms and the tabernacle that were set up there. But they also had to teach God's people. They had the responsibility of putting a difference between the holy and the unholy, between unclean and clean, to discern leprosy and all the various forms of defilement, to cleanse and to cut off, but also to restore back to the camp those who had been cut off. So the responsibility of the priest was very important and certainly varied. Now we could go on down to these. We've got a few more minutes. We can go on down to the. Am I going backwards again? Well, I should do that a lot, don't I? Okay. There we go. Okay. Now, the table of showbread we've talked about is made of acacia wood, and a ring of gold was put on each side. We know all those things. Okay, the dishes, spoons, covers, pitchers, and bowls. Now, those, as we mentioned, were used for holding. About a handful, these little spoons were about the size of a handful. They would be used more like a big kitchen spoon more than a small eating spoon. And they were used to transfer incense from these bowls and cups that would be on the table holding the incense. And the high priest would then put incense on the golden altar off the table of showbread. Here are the bowls and cups. The two remaining sets of vessels attached to the table were bowls and cups, to the use of which they were applied immediately from the words that follow, to pour out withal. Well, the drink offering. Now, there are a couple questions here. On the table of showbread, there was a vial of wine because, as we saw before, there was bread and wine on the table of showbread continually before God. Now, keep in mind that the Passover, of course, we have bread and wine as a type of the new covenant and a type of Christ's body and, of course, His blood. When Abraham made the covenant with God, Melchizedek brought forth bread and wine. So it's a symbol that God has used all down through time. But the drink offering, it says it is poured out. Now, was it poured out on the ground, or was it poured out into a bowl and then taken outside and thrown on the altar? Very likely, the drink offering was poured out into a bowl. It was simply poured out of a pitcher into a larger bowl, and that wine then would be taken out and put on the altar, completely given then or gotten rid of. There are a couple commentaries that thought it was poured out of the ground, but after a while, it'd be a mess, you know, and a bunch of, you know, mud and wine on the floor of your tabernacle. And God, of course, cleanliness is next to godliness, so God would not have wanted that, just logically speaking. But they were probably simply to pour out a drink offering would be to pour out of the pitcher into a bowl and take it outside. It says the drink offerings in the holy place were there for certain occasions. The word translated strong wine occurs in this place, so there was strong wine in the pitcher. That's what the word actually means in the Hebrew. God is not a teetotaler. He actually enjoyed strong wine being poured out. It only occurs in this place, connected with the drink offerings. The principle of the precept seems to be that Israel's daily drink offerings, and also those offered on the great feast days, were to be poured out inside the holy place, that is, inside this tabernacle. Okay, that we then he mentions here that in Solomon, or that in Jesus Christ's time, Josephus mentions there were 10 tables of showbread. And in fact, in Solomon's time, Solomon made 10 tables of showbread, 2 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 18, that were also entirely made of gold. Okay, well, that's as far as we have for today. I think it's been really interesting, some of the studies and some of the things we're finding out. And next time we'll talk about the altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant.